From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, as the Trump administration's revised travel ban takes effect, immigrant advocates in Massachusetts worry about how it will be carried out. Also today, the 10th anniversary of the iPhone, the gadget of the century.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
Plus, big plans for the offshore wind industry in Massachusetts.
If Massachusetts is one of the first hubs for this kind of activity, then Massachusetts companies will have the expertise to be suppliers across the whole eastern U.S.
Also, 50 years later, remembering the impossible dream that made Boston a baseball town.
The pitch is looped towards shortstop. Petrocelli's back. He's got it. The Red Sox win. And it's pandemonium on the field.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Let's begin today with President Trump's travel ban that affects people from six predominantly Muslim countries and which goes into effect at 8 p.m. Eastern Time tonight. It follows this week's Supreme Court decision that allows part of the ban to be reinstated. According to the High Court, anyone with a credible claim of a bona fide relationship with a person or entity inside the United States will still be able to enter the country. But how is the government going to interpret who has those bona fide relationships? In a moment, we'll hear from a Boston-based immigration lawyer. But first, let's go to Alan Gomez, who covers immigration for USA Today. He joins us from Miami. Alan, good to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me, Anthony.
So there are new guidelines from the Trump administration that defines who is considered close family. It seems like it's not completely intuitive or straightforward. So who exactly will be allowed in? Who will not be allowed into the U.S.?
And just to be clear, we're getting some guidance. We're still waiting for quite a bit because there are a lot of questions that remain about how they're going to implement this. But what we know right now is that it has to do with that family connection. And so what the Supreme Court said is that if somebody can prove that they have a, quote, bona fide relationship with right. somebody in the U.S., they will be allowed to continue traveling into the United States. And so what the administration has done is they spent the last couple of days looking at case law, looking at the U.S. laws, and they found a definition in the Immigration and Nationality Act that defines a relative as a parent, spouse, child, an adult son or daughter, a son-in-law or a daughter-in-law, or a sibling. Excluded from that, so this does none of these counts, are grandparents, aunts, uncles, nieces, nephews, cousins, brothers-in-law, and fiancés.
Hmm.
So they've kind of drawn that line right there, and as you can imagine, a lot of us have had questions about why they drew that line, and immigration advocates are already very upset that they seem to have gone with the most restrictive version of what a relative could be. And so that's the family part that we're dealing with. That's what we know so far.
Yeah, one could certainly imagine a family where a grandparent or indeed an aunt or an uncle, a nephew or a niece could be very central to that family. But under these guidelines, those folks would be considered not to have a bona fide relationship and therefore would not be able to come to the U.S.
Exactly. And this is the kind of thing that I would expect that we might see some lawsuits over relatively quickly.
Yeah.
Because, right, this what the Supreme Court did, you know, leave it a little bit vague, so it left it a little bit difficult. But as I said, immigration advocates are already saying that the administration is kind of gone a little bit further and is kind of violating at least the spirit of what the Supreme Court was trying to do. We're probably going to see some more lawsuits coming on this pretty soon.
Now, visa applicants can also get into the U.S. under the terms of this partial ban if they have formal ties to a U.S. entity. What exactly does that mean, or how is the Trump administration going to interpret that?
Luckily on that one, we did get a little bit more guidance from the Supreme Court. So, for example, if you are a national of one of these six countries that are targeted by the ban and you have a standing job offer from a U.S. company, that will qualify. If you're a student in one of these countries and you've been admitted to or are currently enrolled in a U.S. university, you will be allowed to continue traveling. But from there, things get a little bit murkier. So we're not, like, for example, if you're trying to come to the United States on a business visa, but you only have a couple of, let's say, meetings in the United United States. Does that qualify? We still don't know. And they made very clear as well that a refugee who is just beginning the application process, that the nonprofit agency here in the United States, who would sort of be their sponsor and the one that shepherds them through the process, they will not be considered an entity or a bona fide, you know, to establish that bona fide relationship.
Okay.
So refugees who've gone through the process already and are approved to enter the country by July 6th will be allowed to do so, but it looks like those coming afterwards are going to have a much harder time.
Much harder time, because the Trump administration's executive order includes a ban on all refugees to the U.S. for 120 days.
Exactly.
So you're saying they're going to be pretty much out of luck under this new ban.
Right. The only way they'll be able to get in is if they are going through the process and they also have a close relative, like we spoke of before.
Right.
So in other words, so that's the only way they're going to be able to get in for the next 120 days.
According to the Washington Post, and you know, I'm wondering if this is consistent with your reporting, the cap of 50,000 refugees this fiscal year has nearly been reached. According to the Post, we're at 49,008 refugees have been admitted as of Wednesday. So is the question of refugees a moot point anyway, given that the cap has almost been reached?
I mean, the question of the, and this has been one of the more challenging aspects of the Trump administration's attempts to institute a travel ban. Courts have ruled over the past few months that they could not enforce that cap. Prior, it was well over 100,000, the number of refugees that we're admitting, but Trump is trying to lower that to 50,000. Courts have blocked him from doing so. But despite that, the administration in the last few months has been admitting a very, very small number of people. Some historically low numbers of refugees have been getting into the country. So even if that part has been, they've been prevented from lowering the cap that much, in practice, they have slowed down that process. So right, at this point, we're just over 49,000 refugees who've come in this fiscal year. There's only a few months left. And the way that they're going to be handling this now, yeah, it means, you know, maybe we'll pass 50,000, maybe we won't. The Supreme Court made it clear that if refugees applying in the next few months, again, can establish that close family relationship here in the United States, they'll be allowed to come in, but for the most part, it looks like the rest of them will be barred moving forward. So we're probably going to end the fiscal year, if not at 50,000, right around that number.
All right. That's Alan Gomez. He covers immigration for U.S. Today, speaking to us today from Miami. Alan, thank you so much. We really appreciate your reporting and your clarity. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to Susan Church. She's a local immigration lawyer. She was one of the first lawyers to challenge President Trump's executive order on immigration. She chairs the New England chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Susan, thanks for coming back into the studio.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you make of the State Department's guidelines about who will and who will not be allowed into the country? To me, the line seems arbitrary. Is that fair to say?
You know, welcome to immigration law. The lines are arbitrary and unfair all over the process of immigration law, and it causes a lot of frustration for people. They are arbitrary. I'm not sure why grandparents are suddenly a threat to America. I don't see why they're excluded. I'm particularly unhappy with the fiancé visa exclusion. A fiancé comes on a visa called a K visa. When they arrive in the United States, they are required to marry their particular future spouse within 90 days. So they would be a spouse of a U.S. citizen and therefore a qualifying relative were they able to come for the process. So there's a lot of inequity in the cable. There's some good, though. They didn't cancel existing visas, so there will be people who should be allowed to enter if they had a valid visa in time. But there's a lot of problems with it, too.
Well, grandparents, grandchildren, aunts, uncles, nieces, nephews, cousins, brothers-in-laws, and sisters-in-laws, fiancés, as you said, and other extended family members will be kept out. Alan Gomez suggested that this could lead to more litigation. Do you see that happening?
I think it's going to be a little harder to litigate these people if Customs and Border Protections follows the exact guidance that the Department of State has given, meaning that they allow anyone in that is part of the Department of State cable allowed in. I think the litigation would come from the fact when we get into people being allowed by the Department of State, but then Customs and Border Protection arbitrarily cancels their visa there and trying to help the person once they get here. I think we agree that that is an extremely restrictive definition, and it violates the spirit of what the Supreme Court was saying. It didn't. There's no requirement that they go to the INA and use the restrictive definition of the INA. So, yes, there will be opportunities for litigation as far as the restrictiveness of the definition.
Susan, I spoke to you on Monday after the Supreme Court decision, and you mentioned that only a small number of people would really be affected by the ruling, and you actually called the ruling on the travel ban a victory. I'm wondering if you still feel that way today.
I actually feel very strongly that it's a victory, and I had a lot of sleepless nights over what the Supreme Court could have done in response to the petitions by the government. There is a problem with standing for people who don't have any ties to the United States. When I was at the airport during the first travel ban litigation, I didn't see any B visas, which are visitor visas, coming in unless they were mothers of either U.S. citizens or lawful permanent residents who are about to give birth. You know, the grandmothers were getting in to see their grandchildren being born. Yeah. But that was it. That's because we have an incredibly restrictive policy about visas from these countries already. So I was relieved that they said that there are, I mean, in not taking so many people off of the list, there is some rights for visa holders in not restricting the law further. I think it was a victory because it established the right of some people to come here.
I'm wondering if there are families, individuals that you've been working with who are going to be affected by these new guidelines. I mean, we know in general that they are, but I mean, if there are specific people that you have in mind.
I do worry about people who are diversity visa recipients. There are people who are called extraordinary ability recipients. So they have received a visa just because they are so outstanding in their field that they would be a benefit to the United States. Those people are excluded from entering the United States on a granted visa unless they have a close family relative. So there's a whole category of people that are still going to be out there and be affected by this.
Now, the cable from the State Department says that any relationship must be, quote, formal, documented, and formed in the ordinary course rather than for the purpose of evading the executive order. I'm wondering what kind of challenge that poses to some of these folks, to refugees. Are they going to be able to get that kind of level of documentation in order to get their papers in order and get into the United States?
That is what I think most immigration lawyers agree on with this order, is that how is this going to be enforced? How is fairness going to persevere through this? It depends on who gets you at the consulate. It depends on who gets you at Customs and Border Protection. How do you prove this relationship was pre-existing? I think that's where all the opportunities for litigation and the inequities are going to come in.
Well, we'll be watching this closely. Susan Church, she is the chair of the New England chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Susan, thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Stay with us. Coming up, a look at an offshore wind project off the coast of Martha's Vineyard and Massachusetts' commitment to wind energy. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. A big step forward tomorrow for Massachusetts' offshore wind industry. Utilities have put out requests for proposals to buy energy from the first offshore wind farm in the state, off the coast of Martha's Vineyard. It's part of the state's commitment to develop more wind energy, and it represents a potentially huge multi-billion dollar industry in the making. WBUR's Bruce Gellerman has been following the story and joins us in the studio. Hey, Bruce.
Hey, Anthony.
So what's this wind farm going to look like? Where will it be? Tell us some particulars about it.
A lot of water. It's going to be about 15, 14 miles south of Martha's Vineyard. There's three kind of tracks of ocean out there that were bidded successfully by three different companies a few years ago. They got it very cheap, actually, the area, with like a buck an acre. But it's going to be spread out. And the question is, who's going to be, which one of these three companies is going to be the ones that, you know, successfully bid on this, at least this first round of this request for proposal.
All right. So what companies are vying for the contract?
So we have there's three. As I said, there's one by Danish Dong. It's a huge, it's probably the world's largest developer of offshore wind from Copenhagen. And they're teaming up with Eversource and National Grid, which is interesting because Eversource and National Grid are the ones who are going to be buying the energy. So they've got to keep that kind of very separate. Then there's a Vineyard Wind, which is a partnership with actually a Spanish company that owns a Danish company, which is involved in that. And then there's a Deepwater Wind, which is the one, if you remember, Block Island developed the nation's first. It was just a small one, though, five turbines, 30 megawatts. So those are the teams.
I see. All right. And so they're going to be judged. And how will they be judged? What are the utility companies and state regulators looking for?
So they're looking for a couple of things. One thing is the primary one is how much energy can they produce at what price? They have to sign contracts that promising and guaranteeing a 20-year wholesale energy price to these utilities. It's utilities who are putting out the request for the proposal. So they've got to do that. And they also have to guarantee kind of the implications for the environmental effects and the benefits, and what the local economic development is about.
Let's listen to Matthew Beaton. He's Massachusetts Secretary of Energy and Environmental Affairs, talking about sort of the way this offshore wind industry is going to sort of be taking shape off the coast of Massachusetts.
We intentionally wanted to start off slowly because it is a new industry. It has seen great success in Europe. You know, we're just sort of tipping our toe in the water right now to make sure that we're going cautiously but fast enough to actually try to see some of the real economic impacts that we're here to try to promote today.
All right. So there's Matthew Beaton, the Secretary of Energy and Environmental Affairs. So how does all this fit into the state's energy goals, Bruce?
Well, the energy goal is that the state has set last year, the state set a 10-year plan to develop 1,600 megawatts of offshore wind. 1,600 megawatts is about twice what Pilgrim Nuclear Station produces.
Right.
So Pilgrim is, you know, they're pulling the plug on that at the middle of June 2019. So they've got a 10-year goal. And the question is, how much are they going to be producing in this first round? There's going to be three rounds of bidding, of contracts. And I think, from what I hear, it's going to be about 400 megawatts at this first go-round.
All right. Now, Bruce, how big are we talking? I mean, there's a lot of wind out there, a lot of ocean. How big is this industry? Who stands to benefit?
Oh, it's going to be enormous. If you believe the projections, look at Europe. Europe has been doing this for 25 years, right? So they've got 3,600 turbines in the water. We've got five. They've got over, 15 million homes worth of energy being produced by these generators. And the generators are enormous. Now, the bigger the generator, the more efficient they can be. The ones that they're building now in Europe are going to be taller than the Hancock building in
Boston.
That's
amazing. Yeah. Taller than the Hancock
building. Yeah, wow. So over 900 feet.
But see, this brings to mind, I mean, in Massachusetts, we have this sort of bad memory of the Cape Wind project that went on and on and on, was subject to litigation until it was dead in the water or never really got out of the water, I guess. Could these projects face similar fate?
No.
Okay.
I would
Why not?
Be very surprised. Well, Cape Wind was a developer that was trying to sell the energy to the utilities. This is the utilities kind of contracting with the developers.
Important distinction.
Very. And the other thing, there was the opposition. There were smaller turbines. Cape Wind wanted to put in about 450, 460 megawatts. They wanted to build 130 turbines. They're going to be putting in 40 or 50 turbines of these larger size. So they're not going to be, they're going to be way offshore. They're not going to be sitting out in, off the coast of Cape Cod.
Right. Off the Kennedy's Beach.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Finally, when are we going to see these turbines up and running? How far away are we?
Okay. So the deadline is this. So they're going to be soliciting the request for proposals. The proposals are due in April. There's going to be a decision in July. The Department of Public Utilities has to review it. There's a whole other process by which they kind of calculate the cost benefits, and then they start putting steel in the water maybe within about 2 years, 2018, 2019. And then these things go in very quickly. Anthony, they go in a day. They prepare the sites, and they just plop these babies right in the water.
Wow. Yeah. WBUR's Bruce Gellerman talking about the future of wind energy off the coast of Massachusetts. Thanks, Bruce.
You're welcome.
Today marks a significant milestone for a piece of transformative technology. Here's how it was described more than a decade ago.
A widescreen iPod with touch controls, a revolutionary mobile phone, and a breakthrough internet communications device. Today, Apple is going to reinvent the phone.
That was the late Steve Jobs, the former CEO of Apple, describing the very first iteration of the iPhone, which went on sale 10 years ago today. Since then, more than a billion of them have sold, and they have changed our lives, as if you didn't know. We depend on them to browse the internet, to find our way around town, to take pictures, to watch TV and movies, to hold our grocery lists. And sometimes, as Hiawatha Bray says, we even use them to make phone calls. Hiawatha writes about technology for the Boston Globe, and he's with us to talk about 10 years of the iPhone. And Hiawatha, you call it the gadget of the century. Can you remember the world before the iPhone and remind us what it was like?
It's almost impossible to remember a world without the iPhone, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it really is.
Because it has completely changed the way we do almost everything.
Yeah.
I mean, think about it this way. They did not invent the smartphone. Smartphones existed. Believe it or not, the leading smartphone vendor at the time would have been Microsoft. People were actually using this incredibly crude system called, Microsoft Windows Mobile. And it was awful. There was also the BlackBerry, of course.
Yeah.
But nobody had ever figured out a way to do what the iPhone really was. And everybody kept calling them phones, as we still do. But what happened with the iPhone was that it is clear that from beginning to end, top to bottom, what they were really trying to create was the first really usable pocket computer, because that's what it was. It was the first computer where you could stick it in your pocket and then do all the stuff you normally would do on a computer with a device that fit in your pocket. And that ability has literally changed the world. And, you know, it's really one of the most fascinating stories about it is one that a lot of people have forgotten. For the first year after the iPhone comes out, it's reasonably successful, but it doesn't change the world. And the reason why is because Apple didn't want to allow other people to write software to run on it. They said, oh no, if that happens, there'll be all kinds of bugs and viruses. It'll be a complete disaster. We're only going to put our own software on it. But after begging and pleading from all kinds of software developers who said, oh man, you'd be amazed what we could do with this thing if we could just write software for it, they opened the App Store.
Oh boy, and so that made a huge difference. Yeah.
That was the moment.
Hiawatha, you wrote that
people just invented an incredible array of things you could do with it.
Right. When you saw the very first iPhone, what did you think of it? I mean, did you see, wow, this is something, or did you miss the magic?
Not this time. I remember when Jobs made his great comeback and they brought out the first iMac. The first Mac with the ones that had looked like a gigantic cough drop with the weird colors and everything.
Yeah.
I said, this is going to flop. This is going to fail. I was totally, totally wrong.
Hmm.
I did not make that mistake with the iPhone. And the reason was I actually picked it up and touched it. And the moment I picked it up and started using it, I realized that I could almost feel the planet shifting under my feet. And I'll tell you the reason why. The moment I touched it, I knew exactly what to do. I didn't have to read a manual. I didn't have to figure it out. It was the most intuitive piece of high technology I have ever seen. Anybody, a grandmother, anybody could pick it up, and they just knew what to do with it. And I was shocked. I've never seen anything that well designed. To this day, I've never seen anything that well designed.
Interesting. You know, you mentioned the computing power in these little phones, and it's worth remembering, and I love this fact, and correct me if I'm wrong or further define this, but the first computers, I don't know, 40 or 50 years ago, took up, what, two or three rooms at MIT?
Yeah.
And I'm told that the little phones that we carry around in our pockets have more computing power than those computers that used to fill up a couple of full rooms.
No, literally millions of times more.
It's incredible.
It's not even in the same universe. I mean, the computer that was used to land people on the moon had like about 64 kilobytes of memory in it. It's unbelievable. I mean, good grief. Practically every digital device we own, a digital watch has more power than
the computers
of those days.
So it's a revolution. Has the revolution been entirely for the good, in your view?
Almost entirely. I'm trying to think of negative aspects of it.
I can think of one. Distracted drivers, distracted spouses, distracted children.
Yeah, but, you know, I have problems getting too worked up about that, because that's about, you know, the way people use these technologies, and I don't see it's necessarily the technology's fault. I suppose there are other things, like the fact that it has further eroded our privacy, not so much because of the devices themselves, but because we allow ourselves to be tracked by them. Cell phones have always tracked us, but the cellular network tracking is relatively crude. It's like accurate to within half a mile. You put GPS on these things, and suddenly these guys are tracking you to within a few feet, and they're doing it constantly everywhere you go. That's a real issue. That's a real problem. By the way, interesting little tidbit. The original iPhone did not have GPS. It was shocking. They left it out.
Interesting. Hey, Hiawatha, literally we have just seconds left, but give me a prediction. What does the iPhone look like, I don't know, 10 years from now?
I don't know. I mean, you could make a good case that we won't have iPhones in 10 years because increasingly, I was just at MIT and they were talking about weaving semiconductors into your clothes. It's not unimaginable that everything you wear will be a computer. And conceivably, you might just have a Bluetooth headset and the stuff on your body acts as the iPhone. It will just have, I don't know if that will entirely happen, though, unless you also have virtual reality glasses, but you might. And so you might see the existing form factor of the phone disappear, but this was the real turning point that has really made the idea of having computing with you all the time a permanent part of our lives. We're not going back. It may change in form, but we're always going to have that.
Not going back. 10 years ago, the first iPhone was sold. Hiawatha Bray made the prediction that it would make a huge difference in our life, and it did. He writes for the Boston Globe. Hiawatha, thank you as always.
Yeah, it's been fun. Thanks a lot.
Stay with us. Coming up, how the Red Sox impossible dream season turned Boston into a baseball town forever. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Since 2004, the Boston Red Sox have won 3 World Series, and Red Sox Nation has become a kind of regional cult about winning and devotion to a team. But 50 years ago, it was very different. In 1967, just 8,000 fans showed up for opening day at Fenway Park to watch an unpopular team of perennial losers. For 8 straight years, the Sox had finished in the bottom half of the American League. They lost 100 games in 1965, and in one of those games, they drew just 409 fans. Few people expected anything different in 1967, but then the Red Sox started winning, and they kept winning all the way to the final game of the season.
The pitch is looped towards shortstop. Petrocelli's back. He's got it. The Red Sox win. And it's pandemonium on the field.
The Red Sox won the pennant, played in their first World Series since 1946, and even though they lost to St. Louis in 7 games, 1967, the impossible dream season, turned Boston into a baseball town forever. So we're going to go back and look at that season with help from our friends at the Boston Globe, which has an ongoing series about that 1967 season and the summer that changed Boston. With me in the studio is longtime sports writer with the Boston Globe, Bob Ryan, who watched that incredible season unfold and has covered the Sox and just about every other sports story in town. Great to have you back, Bob Ryan.
Thank you, Anthony.
Yeah. And Gordon Eads is with us. He's a veteran sports writer and now the Red Sox team historian. Gordon Eads, great to have you.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Where were you? Were you in Boston 50 years ago for that impossible dream season? Did it turn you into a Red Sox fan for life? What do you remember about it that was 50 years ago today? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Bob, let me start with you. Bob Ryan, remind us of how bad those pre-1967 Red Sox were. I gave a few of the facts, but were they really that bad?
They weren't competitive. The only year, there was only one year after Ted Williams retired in 1960 that they were even remotely a contender, and I believe it was 64 for half a year. That's it. And then, as you pointed out, 65 lost 100-plus games. Drew, by the way, 650,000 people, or as we say today, 2.5 homestands. Seriously. And that is where we were. And then they upped it a little bit in 66. One thing I must say that I was only made aware of much later, no one was paying attention, but they actually had a pretty good second half of 66.
Yeah.
And we had the second best record in the American League after the All-Star break. Still, no one expected anything great in 67.
Yeah. So, Gordon Eads, why were they so bad?
Oh, they just some very mediocre ball club with a very incompetent front office filled with Tom Yawkey's cronies, his drinking buddies. I think you certainly can point to the fact, you know, the curse of the Bambino is a well-established storyline in this town. But for me, I would maintain that the more influential storyline was the curse of Jackie Robinson and the fact that the Red Sox were the last team to integrate, 1959, with Pumpsy Green, a utility infielder, shortstop. And a week later, they brought up a pitcher named Earl Wilson, who 2 years later, 3 years later, I should say, became the first African-American pitcher to throw a no-hitter. So
they were incredibly slow to take advantage, obviously, of that huge wealth of talent out there. Yeah.
And, I mean, one of the great stories, just talking about it in the office today, a famous Red Sox scout by the name of George Digby, the guy who signed Hall of Famer Wade Boggs, he had an opportunity. He recommended a 17-year-old center fielder from the Birmingham Black Barons, who the Red Sox could have had for $5,000, and they passed. And we could have had a decade of seeing Ted Williams and Willie Mays playing side by side.
Wow. Bob Ryan, that 1967 season, where were you? What were you doing? How did you experience that season?
I was in the summer in between my junior and senior years at BC, and it was the first time that I did not go back home after school. I got a job. I had a job that was the auspices of Boston College. 12 of us worked at the old City Hall on School Street, cleaning it out. We took inventory of closets, vaults, desks, etc. And that was my job. So I was in. I had a girlfriend. That was the whole emphasis. Was I had a girlfriend named Elaine Murray, 39 Glenmont Road, Brighton, who is now en route from Maine to Hingham, Massachusetts. We've been married 48 years.
Fantastic.
So anyway, that was the hook why I stayed in Boston. And we didn't go to a game until May, late May, doubleheader. They beat the Indians, and I got hooked. And I went. They were the first two of 27 games I went to that summer, which include being in the stands October 1, 67. One quick story on how that came about. I got paid periodically, and one day I got paid in late July, and I went down at the Red Sox office at lunchtime and bought some tickets for upcoming games. And I'm looking up at the big board, and after I buy tickets for five other games, I say, oh, October 1, the Twins are in town. That might be nice. I'll never quote. And so that's how we wound up with box seats behind home plate for October 1, 67.
Fantastic. Listeners, we're talking to Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe, Gordon Eads, Boston Red Sox historian, and we're talking about 1967, the impossible dreams. He's in 50 years ago when the Red Sox went from literally nowhere to one of the greatest seasons ever in Red Sox history. Changed a lot of people in this greater Boston, New England area, made a lot of them Red Sox fans. I'd have to admit, myself included. And I want to read you guys a quote from Eric Moskowitz's great piece in the Globe, The Summer That Changed Boston. Here it is. It begins with a quote. We'll win more than we'll lose, the new manager had insisted, talking about that 1967 season. But when catcher Russ Gibson tried to wager $20 on it with the Globe's Will McDonough, outfielder Carl Yastrzemski cautioned the rookie not to be so carefree with half a day's pay. A 500 record, not a single man on the roster had played for a Boston team that had managed that. Bet him we'll finish sixth or better, Yaz told Gibson. You're giving him too much of an inch.
I love Ever that. The pragmatist, that Yastrzemski.
But I mean, that just goes to show there wasn't a whole lot of confidence even on the team. So when did it become clear, Gordon Eads, when did it become clear that the Red Sox were turning things around?
Well, I think Bob made a point that's pretty relevant to the discussion, is that in the second half of the 66 season, the Red Sox had started assembling some young talent that actually did win more games than they lost in the second half. And one of the things that strikes me, if you look at the roster, Anthony, of that 67 team, there are 18 players who played for the Red Sox that year who were 25 years of age or younger. Yes, who was stripped of his captaincy in spring training by the new skipper, Dick Williams, was only 27. But, I mean, you go around that infield, they were all 24 years of age or younger. And the other thing that jumps out at you when you look at that roster is, for the first time in the team's history, you had African-American players who made significant contributions. George Scott, first base. Joe Foy, third base. Reggie Smith, center field. A refugee from the Negro National League, John Wyatt, the closer, and then the great Yankees catcher Elston Howard picked up in August for the stretch drive.
So it was the moment when the Sox really sort of finally overcame that unfortunate legacy of essentially ignoring that wonderful pool of black talent out there.
And Dick O'Connell deserves a huge amount of the credit
for that.
So we have
to back up to the key hiring. September 16th, 1965, Dave Moorhead throws a no-hitter before fewer than 3,000 people. But on the concurrent, grabbing the headlines or equal sharing it was the fact that that's the day that Tom Yawkey fired Mike Higgins and hired Dick O'Connell to be his general manager. And Dick O'Connell is the absolute architect. He made important deals during the season. He changed the word wasn't used in those days, but in fact did change the culture of the Red Sox.
Listeners, we want to hear from you. Were you in Boston 50 years ago for that impossible dream season? Did it turn you into a Red Sox fan? Give us a call. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Bob, I asked Gordon the same question. You know, as someone who was watching, you said you went to those terrific games in October, but at what point in the season? Describe what it was like in Boston when people began to sort of take note that, oh my God, something's happening here.
There was a 10-game winning streak on the road in June, into early July, I believe, whenever. But the point, they come back home, and there was a spontaneous a gathering of fans to greet them at the airport. And this was astonishing. This reflected, though, the enthusiasm. That 10-game winning streak is when people said, whoa, well, maybe, wow. And then, you know, you're in the race. Now, the other thing to have to remember about this was a four-team race. It was extraordinary. And it went down to the last weekend as a four-team race. And that was part of the fun of it all. There was so much. I mean, now you're monitoring what are the Tigers doing? What are the White Sox doing? What are the Twins doing? Et cetera. And as well, it was absent from all this discussion, and though, was in fact the Yankees, who were the start of what was the decline period that lasted quite some time. Anyway, just so you know, the Yankees were no part of this, although there were some very memorable games the Red Sox played with them that year, as it turned out, but they were not part of the pennant equation.
Here's one of the memorable games. I want to just play this little clip. So this was a game against the Yankees at Yankee Stadium. Billy Rohr was pitching. He was on the verge of a no-hitter when Tom Tresh comes to the plate. Carl Yastrzemski is playing left field. Let's just listen to a little of this.
Rohr winds. Here it comes. Fly ball to deep left. Yastrzemski is going hard. Way back, way back. And he dives and makes a tremendous catch!
One of the greatest catches we've ever seen. That's just by way of introducing Carl Yastrzemski and sort of what he meant to that team, Bob.
That was very early on.
That was early on.
It was Rohr's first start. And of course, it was one out in the ninth. And we didn't know at that point. Yaz was about to embark on what many people who saw it feel is as good an all-around season as they've ever seen any individual position player have. We didn't know that was, but that was the first. That was the beginning of it.
What happened with that catch? What did he actually do?
Oh, he went. It was over his left shoulder. He ran in the direction of left center field, and the ball was hit over his left shoulder, and he had to time it and make a diving catch, which he did. Of course, but you know the sad ending of the story. Was that Delston Howard broke up the no-hitter with two outs in the ninth and a single to right. Elston Howard, who of course would become a vital part of the puzzle in the second half of the season as a Red Sox. Yeah.
And the great aside to that day, Anthony, is after the game, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis was at the game with her son, John Kennedy Jr., and they asked to be taken into the dugout so John could meet Billy Rohr. And Rohr tells the story, John Jr. asked for his autograph, and Billy Rohr said, if I had been smart, I would have asked for John's autograph because it's worth a hell of a lot more than mine was.
He's an attorney in California now, Billy Rohr.
Fantastic. I want to introduce Tom Melville by way of bringing in first I'll tell you who Tom Melville was. WBUR's executive news director, happens to be my boss. Tom, great to have you.
Anthony, great to be. Anytime you want me to talk about the 1967 Red Sox, Anthony, I'm your man.
The reason why we're bringing Tom on not only because he's a great journalist and observer, but he was a kid. He sort of defines the kind of archetypical young Red Sox fan of that season. So, Tom, give us some memories. What did this season mean to you?
I think the most important part of it for me was that I was nine, and there's something about being a nine-year-old boy growing up in Newton Highlands, listening to every game on the radio. I'm that kid with the transistor radio on the pillow, you know. It was just an innocent time. I feel a little guilty when I say this because I've had a wonderful life, many thrills in my life. I have two great kids. I'm married. I've had a wonderful life. But the biggest thrill I ever had was when they won it on the last day of the season. There were four teams going into the final week, and they had to beat the Twins twice. Detroit had to lose. I was there. I was – oh, the thrill that I felt in my bones.
And the thrill you evidently still feel.
I still feel it. I want to say to my wife and daughters, you know, my wedding day and the birth of you two, they were great. But, oh, my heavens.
I got to say, as someone who was 12 years older than he was at that point,
yeah,
and who's been a lifelong sports fan, as Gordon well knows, and loved baseball and basketball, and went and, you know, had many and covered the Celtics through many glory years in Boston College when actually once upon a time very good in basketball. I hate to tell you. Anyway, that was, Anthony, the single greatest fan experience of my life.
Wow,
that whole summer. Just a snapshot. This is not hyperbole. I know it sounds hyperbolic. I know it sounds over the top. I know it sounds like fiction. It's the gospel truth. You could drive around Boston, and hear the whole game. Turn your radio off and at the stoplight and where you were, and because the guy next to you had the radio on.
So you would hear the game.
Walked around. I had friends in Cambridge that year, and I would go over and visit them at night, walk down the around the neighborhood. Everybody's on the front porch. It was an experience about radio and newspaper. It had very little to do with television.
Yeah.
The games were – there were 50 games on TV on Channel 5. They had the contract mostly on weekends. But it wasn't about TV. It was about radio. It was about Ken Coleman and Ned Martin.
That's right.
And it was about newspaper coverage of the Boston Record, the Boston Herald and the Traveler, and the Boston Globe. And that radio coverage was what made it resonate for us.
It was Ken Coleman and Ned Martin and Mel Parnell, the left-handed pitcher from the Red Sox for the 50s. He was like the analyst type. But those three dudes were just lighting it up. Oh, my God.
So it's funny Bob, you say it wasn't about TV. And I know you're right, because I remember, too, listening to those games on the radio. But here's what I remember about TV. And it's a reminder of a couple of things about how different baseball was then. So I was in the fourth grade. My fourth grade teacher brought a little black and white TV in and put it on the desk. And we didn't have classes that day. This was the World Series. Mm-hmm. And they were in the World Series. And we got to watch the World Series in the middle of the day, which says something about the way baseball has changed.
1 o'clock start.
On a little black and white TV in our fourth grade classroom. And it was something like you, Tom. This was sort of my sort of introduction and seduction by the Boston Red Sox.
I'd been a fan. I went to my first game in 64 and Tony Conigliaro's rookie season. Saw him hit a home run. So I was already a fan, but that it to me, 1967 was the birth of Red Sox
Nation. Here's where we were, and it's unquestionably the dividing line in Red Sox history. Everything that these people are enjoying today, this regime, is a result of the forces that were set in motion in 67. Here's where they were with regard to the fears about attendance. They invited representatives of the local college newspapers down to Fenway Park for a meeting before we went home for school to ask, brainstorm. I was the representative of the Boston College Heights. Brainstorm what might we do to stimulate interest to get some people in the college community to come out to come to these games. That's where they were. They were desperate to find a new source of fandom in Boston. So that's unimaginable. That's where we were. Yeah.
Anthony, as great a season as Carl Yastrzemski had that year, and arguably it may have been the greatest single season performance by any player in baseball history. You could make that argument. Won the Triple Crown last 2 weeks of the season, 23 for 44. Last weekend of the season, 7 for 8. All that said, I think you could also say that Carl Yastrzemski single-handedly destroyed thousands of Little League careers, because every kid tried to emulate Yaz's stance where they held
the bat way up high.
You got it. You remember, Anthony.
Yep.
And that's why you and I probably both hit below the Mendoza line in Little League.
Did your family buy Big Yaz bread?
I remember Yaz
you
bread.
Must've.
Yeah, I do remember Yaz bread. I don't think my parents looked so fondly on Yaz bread, but that had to do with nutrition or something. But we got something a little bit to listen to, speaking of Carl Yastrzemski here.
Yeah, just came.
Just came.
Tom, if you want to sing along, go ahead.
I could.
Tom, tell us the truth. This was your best Christmas present that year.
That's exactly where. So they, I don't know when they started marketing. This is a long-playing vinyl album called The Impossible Dream.
Fleetwood Records.
Out of Revere, Mass.
And they started advertising this on TV, and I don't know, Thanksgiving. And I never wanted a Christmas present so badly in my life. My parents would say, no, Tommy, we're not going to get that for you. We had enough baseball. You're not going to get it. And I got it on Christmas morning. It was so wonderful. I memorized the thing.
Yeah.
I can the poetry.
Go ahead.
Give us a little bit, Tommy. We'll fade out this Yaz song.
Okay,
give us a little poetry.
This is an important topic, too. Tony Conigliaro. We haven't gone there.
That's right.
And then one night, the kid in Wright lies sprawling in the dirt. The fastball struck him square. He's down. Is Tony badly hurt?
Fabulous.
Well, the doctors say he'll be okay, but he won't be back this year. If Tony's through, what can they do? Who will carry them from here? And then it goes right into ba 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 Carl Yastrzemski. Ba ba ba. No, but it was a tragic thing. Tony Conigliaro played baseball at St. Mary's of Lynn, and I think within a year of finishing his baseball career at St. Mary's of Lynn, it's 64, and he's playing for the Red Sox. He was the youngest player to ever hit 100 home runs.
Correct.
He was a local kid made. He was 22 in 67. He had a singing voice. He was in Hollywood singing.
I had the record. Too tight a hit, the little red scooter, and playing the field.
He was a baseball god.
Now, I just want to remind listeners who might not recall or might not have been around, so he was a terrific athlete, right fielder, great at the plate. He took a terrific beaning, and he missed the World Series, came back, but he was never the same, right?
He came back, and miraculously, but in 1970, he had 36 homers and 116 RBIs, basically with one eye. And how he ever did it, we'll never know. And then they traded him to California, and he played as long as 75. Actually, came up and hit a home run early.
In 75, he made another comeback with the Red Sox.
Yes, he did.
He was the opening day designated hitter.
Yep. He hit a home run on opening day.
But I was there that night, and the hush in the field, and it was a crazy night. There was a smoke bomb thrown out of onto the field. There was Gary Bell had a perfect game into the fifth, a no hitter into the seventh. Jimmy Hall hit a home run in the seventh. Break it up, hit another one in the ninth, but all kinds of craziness. But that was the night though that Tony C got hit. I'll never forget it.
Let's take some calls. We've got time for a few. Let's go to Joanne, who's calling from Littleton. Joanne, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I was 9 years old and living in Newton Highlands that season. In fact, Tommy Melville is a high school classmate of mine.
Tommy Melville, right here in the studio.
Is this Joanne Wise?
Yeah.
Joanne Wise?
It's Joanne.
Joanne Derry?
Yes.
Hi, Joanne, how are you?
So, Joanne, what's your memory?
Good, how are you?
Good.
So, my oldest brother and I, we could ride the T for a dime.
Yep.
So, my mother would put us on the, she would just give us, like, I think she gave us $5. And she'd send us down to Elliott T Stop. We get on the T for a dime and ride several stops to get to Fenway. We could get tickets to go to the bleachers, and we still had enough money left over to each get a hot dog. And she would get rid of two of her five kids for a whole afternoon. We did that a lot that summer, and it was just the best. I loved that summer.
Joanne, thanks so much for that memory.
Thanks for calling, Joanne.
Let's go to Mary, who's calling from Franklin. Mary, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am a 1967 graduate of the Boston City Hospital School of Nursing, getting ready to celebrate our 50th, and I am enticing my fellow graduates with some of the copies of the Boston Globe paper. But in 67, working on those wards as ready to graduate, the interns and residents, to try to get them out of the hall to come down and away from the radio, which I love that story about the radio,
yeah.
They would be like, but you grew up in Boston. We're not even from Boston, and we can't get away from it. It was hysterical. All these guys were just insane about every game.
Mary, thank you for the call so much. We've only got a couple of minutes left, and I wouldn't feel right letting you, Bob Ryan, and Gordon Eads leave without asking a quick question about the current edition of the Red Sox. What do you see? What do you like?
What I like is the young talent. I like the Bees. I like the Betts, the Benintendi, the Bogaerts, the Bradley, and I like that. You'll have to like Chris Sale. I don't think I think their best baseball's ahead of them. I think they have enough time to get the rotation straightened out. I hope that Eduardo Rodriguez can finally get healthy and pitch, because he looked great before he got hurt this time. Nobody's running away with the division. They do have a critical stretch right now. Tampa Bay, who's playing better, and then they come right out of the All-Star game with the Yankees. They're in it. They're going to be in it. I totally expect us to have a very exciting September.
All right. What do you think, Gordon?
I think it's very encouraging, the fact that even though we've had a season where we've already gone through 7 third basemen, we've lost the knuckleballer Stephen Wright for the year. David Price missed the first 2 months. Hanley Ramirez hasn't been able to play first base and hasn't been hitting. All of that said, and we're still in first place. And I would tend to agree with Bob that our best baseball is still ahead of us. Dave Dombrowski tends to be very aggressive at the All-Star break, before the training deadline, so I would expect some move or two.
All right, Gordon Eads, Boston Red Sox historian, Bob Ryan, Boston Globe sports writer. Thank you both for coming in.
You're welcome.
Today.
I hope you have some newfound respect for your news director.
And my news director, Tom Melville, and Red Sox fan extraordinaire. Thank you, Tommy.
Thank you, Anthony. Thank you.
A lot of fun remembering 1967, the impossible dream season 50 years ago. That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.